Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show, and my guests will have different spiritual belief systems. Some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my guest is Beth Miller. Beth will be joining us in a little while. And I would like to let the listeners know that starting next week, there's going to be a second weekly show. So I'm now going to be on Thursday afternoons, Eastern Time at 3:30 p.m., as well as Friday nights at 7:30 p.m. And next week, I will have on a church musician of 70 years, and I will have on Rob Anthony, who is a radio personality, and he will be on the Friday show, my 70-year-long church musician, meaning that he's actually been in the profession for 70 years, will be my Thursday 3:30 afternoon show. And as for me, I have been continuing to work on my 14th book in the Sister Mary Olga series, and I'm about a third of the way through it. And for those of you who don't know, I write books about a naughty nun who teaches classes in advanced holiness, and she loves her bourbon and her Marlboros. And the first two books in the series are out. I'm working on book number 14 now, so I have quite a few more to get out there. But the books are written under a pen name, and they're entitled The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude and Babes in Bucksnort. So tonight, my guest is Beth Miller, and Beth loves listening to stories and hearing poems read out loud. She loves spending time in the woods and in dreams. She sees the world through young colored glasses. Sometimes she writes poems and prose of her own. Her favorite styles of writing are haiku and meditative journaling. She lives in the town of Owasco in the Finger Lakes region of central New York, and she's married to Lauren Miller, a musician who frequently accompanies her when she does poetry readings. Beth is also employed on a part-time basis at the center, which is a health and wellness spa. Aside from office duties there, she occasionally leads seminars on creative journal writing. Beth's spirituality embraces the philosophy of ahimsa, or nonviolence. She helped establish two ongoing groups that advocate kindness toward animals. They are People for Animal Rights, based in Syracuse, New York, and the Auburn Area Vegans. She also does volunteer work for Matthew House, which is a residence in Auburn, New York, under the auspices of Hospice of Finger Lakes. And now I would like to introduce my special guest, Beth Miller. Beth, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, David. Thank you.
Oh, good. It's great to hear your voice. I have been looking forward to this opportunity, and it's an honor to have you on the show. I feel humbled each week with each new guest that I'm privileged to have on the show. And what I like to do at the beginning of the show is ask each of my guests, and tonight you're the lucky one, I like to ask them a little bit about their background. And so I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your growing up years and what were your early inspirations?
Oh, okay. Well, I was born on November 29th, 1949, to parents who already raised three children to adulthood.
Oh,
so
my.
It was kind of a unique household. And I lived on the north side of Syracuse, New York, which was a multi-ethnic neighborhood where there were German families, Italian families, Jewish families, a Filipino lady who lived next door to one of the veterans on the street. So it was kind of a diverse neighborhood. I lived in the house, a very big, drafty Victorian house on Jasper Street, with elders. My parents, of course, were in their mid-40s when I was born, and I lived with my maternal grandmother, my paternal grandfather, and my uncle, who was blind. My mother pretty much was the caretaker. And so I kind of grew up in a house of elders, which
wow.
made quite a big difference in my life compared to maybe other children.
Mm.
But along with the elders who I lived with, frequently there were visits from other aunts and uncles, and two of those aunts had a profound influence on me. They were both Sunday school teachers. My Aunt Helen, who was kind of the Katharine Hepburn of the family, she liked drama. She was an amazing storyteller, and she used to color beautiful flannel landscapes and temples and interior scenes for the flannel graph story she would tell, and then she would take paper dolls and unfold, you know, the stories by manipulating the dolls on the flannel.
And oh, cool.
She was really great, but, you know, the gift that she gave to me were these rich stories of, you know, things, you know, stories like David and Goliath, Moses and the bulrushes,
mm-hmm.
The feeding of the 5,000. And I can remember she told the story of the lost sheep, where Jesus would go out, or the shepherd would go out and find the sheep if it got lost.
Sure.
So I had those very rich biblical images. And my other aunt, who had a profound influence on my life, was my Aunt Mary, who was also a Sunday school teacher, and of course, they were teachers of the primary grades levels, young, very young children.
Mm-hmm.
But she had a wonderful voice. And in fact, sometimes I would giggle when she would sing because she had this booming operatic voice. But she gave me the gift of really giving me an amazing, caring attention, which I don't know if a lot of children have these days, when adults would actually sit down and for many hours, you know, talk and take my hand and go for walks down the street to the store. Or she would
Isn't
just
that
spend
wonderful.
Time. And she also was an excellent storyteller. So I feel as though I had those riches in my life. And, of course, my mother was and father were my primary spiritual teachers, in the sense that just by their example, I learned a lot about what love involves and commitment and sacrifice and endurance. So I was very lucky, but I was also kind of had a heaviness and a sadness because there was a part of me that wanted to be a kid. And I feel as though I didn't have too much of a chance to be just a regular child, just a regular kid. And
was that because of all the because of living in the house with all the elders? Is that what
right.
you're referring to?
Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, of course, there were the health issues that were involved, and it was kind of a scary thing sometimes, unempowering to, you know, see my grandmother, who was very frail, and my uncle, who was, you know, had difficulty seeing. It was a little bit hard for a child, because
sure.
I know that probably other kids my age didn't have nightmares when they went to school of their teachers
mm.
breaking their hips,
mm.
which I did. But fortunately, I had made a very good friend across the street. His name was Larry, and Larry and I used to just love nature, and we would go and collect bugs, and we would look at the sky with telescopes and look at plants and things under microscopes, and we had a really nice friendship. But one of the early traumas was that Larry's father got transferred to Florida with his job, and the family had to leave. So my friend Larry left, and that was, I think, a deeply disappointing loss.
Oh, it must have been.
So I have a little a series of three little haikus that kind of talk about my childhood and my
reaction. Oh, I'd love to have you share them. Yes, that would be wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. One. Beach ball got away, caught by wind, carried to sea, reaching arms, give up. Two. Gulls cry over waves. Far out on salty ocean, beach ball rocks and rolls. Three. Sunsets, colors fade. Whales moan haunting rhythmic songs. Moonbeams kiss beach ball.
Hmm.
Yep.
Can you tell me how you relate the words and the what's the imagery in the haiku, and how is that related to your childhood?
Well, the beach ball kind of represents the fun and carefreeness of childhood, and it kind of just got away. It got away,
mm.
especially when my friend Larry left.
Mm-hmm.
And but in the meantime, with this beach ball, this maybe my child part of myself was kind of abandoned out in the ocean, so to speak.
Okay.
It was still able to be buoyant because of the rich stories from my elders that sustained
okay.
me. You know, having those stories of like the lost sheep being loved and found and rescued, it kind of gave me a certain faith. So even though there was a sadness and kind of a heaviness about my childhood, I felt like the moonbeams kissed the beach ball. In other words, I was loved by something divine, something that I knew, something like God or the great mystery kissed me. Even though
mm.
I felt abandoned, so that, you know, so that is kind of the process of those haikus.
Well, thank you for sharing both the haikus and also relating that to your childhood. It makes sense to me now. I was just stuck on some other imagery as you were reading it, and I wasn't relating it. So that's very helpful. I would think one of the gifts of your childhood, having grown up in that household with the elders, would have been that you would have learned a great deal of compassion for people that are older or infirm. I certainly see you as a very compassionate person. What do you think about that?
Yes, I certainly do have an empathy for the elders, and I still, however, connect with a sort of feeling of powerlessness sometimes when I seek so much to want to help, to make things better, and sometimes things don't get better.
Right.
So part of my work with hospice and other particular jobs I've had over the years, I have made an effort to educate myself on different ways in which I could be of comfort and support to people who were aging.
Mm-hmm.
But I never know if I really am, because I think that somehow still inside me is a little bit of nervousness about it, you know? So I don't know. People can kind of pick up on that kind of thing.
Well, I'm wondering, does it have to do with the idea that really the only thing you can do is be there and listen and be supportive? Obviously, in a hospice type of situation, you can't fix the other person. And when you were talking, I just had this thought of how I like to try to fix things and people,
yeah.
And I recognize that the only thing that I can change for myself is my own behavior and my own thoughts and my own actions, and so I just was a little bit curious about that.
Yes, and one of the lessons that kind of was indirect to this issue was my own benefit from caring attention. I remember I one time studied Virginia Satir. Are you familiar with a family therapist?
Yes.
And I can remember she once said one of the greatest gifts that she could conceive of from getting from someone is to be truly seen by them and heard by them and touched by them. So, you know, it is an amazing treasure to really be given full attention. And I think that is one of my things that I like to do when I'm with someone who might be elderly or ill or wanting of comfort. I try to give them complete attention. So I think that's
important.
Well,
thank you. Yes, I think that's very important. And I know that you, another one of your favorite people to have studied has been Carl Jung, hence the looking at the world through Jung colored glasses.
Right.
When did you begin to study Carl Jung?
Well, it's an interesting kind of process here. When I first went to Sunday school, for example, I liked it because my aunts were there. But as I got older, I developed some psychosomatic symptoms in regards to going to church, to Sunday school, and basically to school in general. I didn't really like to be in organizations and institutions, and actually to this day I don't really care to be too regimented and stifled.
Mm.
But I discovered that, you know, I didn't particularly like to be in group settings so much. So that was just something in the background that I will proceed my discovery of Jung with. As I mentioned, my youngest sister, who's approximately near almost 20 years older than I am, was in college when I arrived on the scene, was born. So she was had some college books around the house. And when I was probably in, I don't know, ninth grade or 10th grade, something like that, I picked up one of her college psychology books and happened to read a chapter in it that just grabbed my attention. And the book described that there were basically two general orientations that people had in life. One was either introverted, or one was extroverted. And it was the first time I had sort of a reflection of who I was, in a sense. And the book went on to describe what an introverted nature would be like and describe some very famous, wonderful introverts, and the same with extroversion. And I realized right then I was introverted, and it was okay to be introverted. I was not unworthy because I wasn't extroverted, and I guess it was all right to be that way. Well, that was my very first exposure to Jung, and then, of course, I went and explored other of his philosophy and writings. In case your readers are interested, there's a wealth of information on YouTube about Carl Jung, having his, he has many interviews that people can listen to and hear him speak about his beliefs.
Can you tell the listeners some of what Carl Jung taught, Beth?
Sure. What seems to be important to me right now, because he was a really prolific writer and thinker, and he has an unfathomable amount of insight into the human psyche, but what particularly interests me is his focus on the shadow, the human shadow, that we all have a shadow side. Now, there could be a bright shadow and a dark shadow. For example, we could identify our bright shadow by just identifying who we find to be our heroes. Those people are, they have characteristics or traits that we may not allow ourselves to acknowledge that are part of ourselves.
Okay.
And the same with the dark shadow. We can kind of find out many things about our dark shadow by who it is that we don't like, who bothers us, who, you know, in particular, you know, some annoyances that people display. Perhaps those are the very kinds of annoyances we display to others, but we do not allow ourselves to recognize that that's part of us.
That's interesting. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, so by recognizing these dastardly traits in other people, we're projecting out. And it's through our projections that is the beginning of violence and disturbance in the world. So as a gift to the world, it takes a lot of moral courage, but it's a very good thing to do for the sake of world peace, to try to develop a relationship with this unconscious, to find what is in your shadow, and then to understand it better, and then to become friends with it. And it's all a kind of a process. Now, Jung would suggest different techniques to understand the shadow. I can give you an example of one of my experiences of my shadow popping out.
Sure.
I used to work in a very, very busy office, and my boss was expecting a visitor, a rather important visitor. And I had huge amounts of work to prepare for this visitor. Well, the visitor came. He was a bit early. He came in and went to see my boss. And shortly, in a few minutes, my boss at the time, now this was back in the day when a woman's wages were 59 cents to every dollar a man made, and it was kind of an oppressive situation for women office workers. But in the midst of all of these responsibilities I had, I heard my name being called from my boss's office. And he said, "Beth, would you mind coming in here, please?" And, you know, in the throes of all this work that I had to get ready to do, I dropped what I was doing and I went in, and he says, "Would you mind getting us a cup of coffee?"
Oh, my.
And just unprecedented, this leaped out of my mouth saying, I'm not your handmaiden. Get it yourself. You know?
Good for you.
it led to deep trouble. That's an example. Like, I did never anticipate ever expecting, you know. But the anger was there. It was lurking in there. So now, according to Jung, there's techniques, you know, to get to know our shadow better, and one of them is journaling. One of them is to observe our dreams, sometimes to write our dreams down and illustrate our dreams, think about them from time to time, or to observe how we feel about other people, what we notice about other people, and, of course, to observe these little slips of tongue. So.
Well, I was fascinated by your talking about the bright shadow and the dark shadow. It makes me think about doing a fourth step in the 12-step recovery program. And I've shared with the listeners that I'm active in 12-step recovery, and the fourth step is about taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And in doing that, and I just recently went through another fourth step, it's a continual process of peeling back the layers of the onion, if you will.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of taking a look at those dark sides, basically the pros and the cons of the self. And so I was really thinking along those lines when you were talking about the shadow and how important it is for me when I see something reflected in another person that I don't particularly want to take a look at, or that disturbs me, that it really is something I need to take a look at within myself. And likewise, the qualities that I admire in other people are certainly qualities that I may possess or that may be latent within me, and I've come to realize that, how important that's been in my life's journey. So thank you for sharing about that. I wanted to back up a little bit and ask you about what was significant about your move to Auburn, New York from Syracuse.
Yes. Well, when I was in my mid-30s, I decided to move to Auburn because I was offered a position working as a vocational counselor serving people with developmental disabilities. So I moved to Auburn and found it to be not that far from Syracuse, but yet it was kind of a different world for me. Because in Syracuse, it was very urban for me, living in the north side there, and kind of a city environment. Kind of a little bit reluctant to go out after dark and walk around. But in Auburn, I was able to find a little house eventually.
Mm.
And it's near a big meadow in the backyard. And it's wonderful. It kind of is a flavor of the Finger Lakes area, which it has kind of a few unique characteristics that kind of set a vibration around the city.
Mm.
Some of the notorious claims to fame is that one of the dark sides is that it has a very large state prison. And and another thing is that it has a massive population of crows, and that has actually received national attention. The crows, they kind of migrate into the farming fields during the day, and then they come back at night to roost in trees near the prison. I don't know if it's why they choose the prison area, but they kind of come back and massive numbers to roost in the trees in downtown Auburn. So that's one of the other characteristics I kind of have been intrigued by, because I really like to watch birds and nature, and the crows are fascinating. Also, it's the home of Harriet Tubman, the famous liberator of slaves. Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of vineyards not too far from here where there's wineries and bus tours that go through. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very nice area, especially if you like nature, because some of the there's glacial gorges and waterfall, glacially formed waterfall areas that fortunately during the Depression, the Conservation Corps would come and build beautiful pathways and bridges, similar probably to Green Lakes in Syracuse. But, you know, I feel as though it's quite a nice place to live, and it's much easier for me to go out and walk around and, you know, not fear my, you know, being mugged and all that.
Oh, sure. Sure, I can imagine. It is. It's a lovely community. I have been through it many times. And for those of you who don't know, the Finger Lakes is a region within central New York and central to towards western New York. And they're lakes that look like fingers, and there are actually are more than five of them, I believe. Aren't there, Beth? Something
there
like
11.
Eight?
11.
11 of them.
11 altogether.
And they were all scooped out by the glaciers retreating, and it's a beautiful region, the Finger Lakes area. I was thinking a little bit about what you were saying earlier when you first discovered the books on Jung and discovered that it was okay to be an introvert. It's amazing how many people early in life, for whatever reason, feel that they're not worthy of whatever it is, because they perceive themselves to be different from others. And I'm wondering, when you made that discovery that there were introverts and that it was okay, was that like a big light bulb for you?
It kind of was. And the fact that, I became a little bit more patient with myself and, realized that, I knew I had to go to school and go to confirmation class and go to these places, but, I didn't really like to go to brownies and ethnic German dancing classes and, things like that just made me shiver with revulsion. But what I eventually did find that kind of was a comfort to some of the issues with not really enjoying a lot of the social outlets that my parents were trying to encourage me to do. I did, when I was early in teen, discover a couple things that really resonated with me. One was music. I loved rock and roll music, folk music, and it was during the times when music was really a big deal for a lot of people. I loved music, and I also just began to start my journaling around that time. And through the course of my love for music, I did meet some nice girlfriends, and we used to sing together sometimes and play, guitar. I played a very basic couple, folk songs on guitar, and it was just a really great, great time as far as music goes. Mm-hmm. And I know that actually when I was in my 30s, I looked back at that point and thought, gee, music has meant so much to me. I think I'll do a little music autobiography.
So oh,
I kind
cool.
of, reviewed all of the songs that really meant a lot to me from as far back as I could remember, starting actually with the Disney show Pinocchio with the beautiful When You Wish Upon a Star.
I love that song.
It was one of my very favorite first loved music pieces. But then, you know, I kind of just gathered up a lot of different musical songs that I enjoyed, and I put them all on a couple cassettes, you know, so I don't know if you'd recognize some of them, but, you know, Wasn't Born to Follow was one of them. All Alone Am I by Brenda Lee, or I think it was by Brenda Lee. There's School Day by Chuck Berry, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, of course.
Oh, sure.
To Sir With Love was especially important to me because I went to see that movie, To Sir With Love, 1 week before my father suddenly died.
Oh, my.
You know, the song just absolutely describes, there's lyrics in it like, how do you take someone from crayons to perfume? You know, it's just, the lyrics just made me totally able to kind of cry it out. I was at first unable to express any emotion. I was so frozen with shock because I was with my father when he had this terrible massive heart attack. And died.
That must have been so traumatic for you.
Yes. But that song allowed the floodgates to open, and I was able to really cry finally about my father's death. But, you know, the songs, I can just remember different times when these songs meant a lot to me, the Beatles songs, of course, and, you know, it just was terrific. And then with the journaling, how I began that was I started to collect quotations that I liked. And so I would gather these quotations that spoke to me. So that another step along my spiritual way was one of the girlfriends I had, another person that loved music, said, have you ever read the book The Prophet? And I
did. What a wonderful book.
And that kind of then became a Bible to me. I loved the book. So that was another important step along the way. And it kind of took me a little bit away from the church that I was brought up with and kind of set me on a little bit more freer spiritual course.
What was the church that you were brought up in?
Well, it was a Lutheran church.
Okay.
And the irony was that there were actually three Lutheran churches on the corner of Butternut and Prospect Streets where I lived. I don't know why they just couldn't. Eventually, over time, they did merge a little bit. But, yeah, there were three of them. And aside from the earliest years when I went to Sunday school with my aunts, it wasn't really hugely fun for me to go. But, yeah, started off as a Lutheran.
I love the way you described that. It wasn't hugely fun for me to go. You know, that describes my experience going to church as a kid. If it weren't for the music, I...
Right.
Don't know how I would have survived because there was absolutely no experience of the Holy Spirit for me as a kid. I would sit there and practically fall asleep during sermons. They just didn't keep my attention, and my experience has changed so much over the years in the church that I go to now.
Yeah.
That's funny. Let's back up a little bit. I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about your journal writing because you teach creative journal writing. Can you tell somebody how they could do that on their own?
Well, it's just a matter of writing down your reflections about what you observe or feel or think. And it's really quite a helpful tool, and a lot of times, as opposed to just doing this with words and writing, you can do it like with collage. You can find pictures that resonate to you or describe an interior feeling. I just generally find that what I usually try to talk about in the little classes that I do is that journaling does help you to savor your life.
Mm.
It's kind of like there's no such thing as an unimportant day.
Mm. That, I like that.
Each day has its treasure, and many times you can kind of like remember that day in your writing of a journal. And it also, another really important part of journaling is it does help us discover the truth about ourselves. For example, if I were to write about an encounter I had with a coworker or friend,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe a week later go back and read it, I could say, I said that? Why?
Mm.
What mm-hmm. was it that made me say that? Oh, probably the shadow, you know. I see some envy in this statement, or why would I have embarrassed someone by saying something like that in the context of that situation? Or, you know, it kind of helps you get some insights. And, of course, you know, one of the goals in most of our lives is that we don't want to hurt others.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to be hurt, and we don't want to hurt others. And like I said, it really does take a certain amount of moral courage to do shadow work, and journaling is a tool in which that work can be done.
Mm.
And, of course, the other aspect of journal writing that's very valuable is the fact that when you're going through really tough times, sometimes it's just helpful to take the heaviness, the heavy weight of those feelings and put them out on paper so that at least you can lighten up. You know,
yeah.
I remember one of my friends who was, he had so many illnesses, and I can remember him writing in his journal that he shared with me. He said, I am not my illnesses. I am how did he put it? I am a scarlet leaf that's whirling on a main brook. And, you know,
oh.
He just went on to describe, you know, that he is not going to, you know, he's kind of dissociating with that pain and allowing the beauty and joy in his life to come in. He might not.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He might not be void of the pain, of course, but he is able to hold that paradox. Whereas instead of drowning in despair of being in the pain and disempowering power of those illnesses, he can connect through his writing
mm-hmm.
And express to others that, yeah, he's still a human being and still can experience joy, you know, in a very paradoxical way.
That's a beautiful example. And isn't life full of paradoxes? Just amazing the journey that we travel on, and big part of your journey, and you were just recently talking about not doing harm, but a big part of your journey has been about your vegan philosophy, and I wondered if you could share with us when and why you became a vegan, and if you would be willing to talk a little bit about the vegan philosophy.
Sure. Well, you know, of course, the whole thing with going from basically our culture is very meat-oriented, and so is my family, and I learned to like those foods. But over time, over a process, and I'm still not completely perfect in abstaining from all animal products, but it's a striving towards a plant-based diet. And how this all began was as a little seed. One Sunday morning, I can remember it so vividly because it was such a moving and aha kind of moment for me. I was much younger. It was in the 80s, I think, that I was awoke by my alarm clock radio. And instead of hearing music or a DJ speaking, I heard as I was awakening the sound of the singing of wolves. And it was quite a long piece of these wolves singing, and then a gradual introduction of some music with the wolves singing. And then there was an interview by the members of the band, the Paul Winter Consort.
Oh, I love Paul Winter.
Oh, so you know who they are. It's a group of
musicians. Oh, I do. I've heard them live, and I have a lot of their music. But
yeah,
please continue.
They incorporate the sounds of animals in their music. And then they started to talk about some of the conditions of these animals, such as the wolves at the time, who were at that point endangered. And they incorporated sounds of eagle, who at that time were endangered, and whales. They actually, heard the sounds of whales.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it was just awakened to the wonder and of the diversity and beauty of this earth. You know, it was like a mystical experience, really.
Mm.
And as now, one of Jung's favorite words would be synchronicity. You know, when the heart has yearnings or is awakening in a certain path, people will come along on the way that you're meant to meet. So at that time in my life, I worked for a little theatrical supply company where I sold theatrical makeup, and a lady came in. She was a very nice lady, and she said, "I was wondering, do you happen to sell makeup brushes that don't have seal sable in them?" And I said, "You care about this too."
Oh.
And she said, "Oh, you know what I mean?" I said, "Yes." And I took her to these brushes that had synthetic brushes, and I said, you know, she said, so we got into a conversation, and she said, "You know, there's a group of us, a small group of us, that want to begin a group for animal rights. And would you be interested in coming to our initial meeting?" Now, this was in 1982.
Okay.
And that very night, I went to the meeting, and PAR was, the People for Animal Rights, was established, and it still continues today, as a grassroots organization that seeks to educate people about animals, and they host vegan gatherings and help promote, help give out educational materials and have speakers. I no longer am actively involved with PAR, except on a few occasions. I might help out with manning a table or something like that. But because I've moved from Syracuse now, but my friendship with Linda DiStefano, who's very active in it still, has just thrived. And one of the high points of my time with the group was that we invited the Paul Winter Consort to come to Syracuse, and they did.
Oh, wonderful.
And, we had a little party for them after their show, and I sat down and played backgammon with one of the band members.
Oh, wow. Wow,
oh,
what
an... I was so happy.
I can imagine.
It was a nice experience. But I do love their music, and that was what began to deepen my heart towards animals. And it was over time then that, you know, it's kind of easy for folks to really empathize a lot with the whales and the eagles and the wolves and the elephants. But there's also farm animals that are terribly abused. I mean, and knowing this and learning more about the plight of the farm animals and seeing documentaries of taken, and then myself having visited some of the dairy farms near here and seeing how some of the chickens are raised, it was a process, but I decided I want to be a vegan. So that decision was made last year in 2012. I was a vegetarian for a while, and then I wanted to go another step beyond to, try to eliminate cheese and eggs and milk products and all, yogurt and things like that.
Wow.
In 2012, I started the Auburn Area Vegan Group.
Good for
along
you.
Along with a friend. So one of the things I read recently, as you know, I collect quotations.
Mm-hmm.
This woman called Peace Pilgrim, she is quoted to say, like, you've much more power when you're working for the right thing than when you are working against the wrong thing.
Mm.
So in the design of the vegan group, I wanted it to be a joyful experience of the diversity of foods that were non-animal based, that were plant-based. And
mm-hmm.
so we have monthly meetings with when we have nice vegan dishes, and we share recipes. And, you know, when you're on a path like this, that, you know, in Auburn there is not really one vegan restaurant. When you're on a path that's so kind of countercultural, it does help to meet friends along the way. It makes the world not quite so lonely.
Oh, I'm sure.
So that's how the group started.
Well, I wish you lots of luck with that. I'm curious about the philosophy of ahimsa. You've mentioned that your spirituality embraces that philosophy. Could you tell me more about that?
Well, one of the greatest examples, I believe, of a person who really put his life on the line for his beliefs in peace was Mahatma Gandhi.
Sure.
And he was, of course, a proponent of this philosophy of ahimsa, which basically means to try to do as little harm as possible and to respect life, not just human life, but all life forms. And so there's evidence of this philosophy in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in Jainism, and, you know, other religions as well. Like the Native Americans, for example,
mm-hmm.
are much more, even though they hunt, and they're respectful of the animals. They don't make them into machines and factory farm them and abuse, you know, they honor the animals, you know. So anyway, ahimsa is the desire to do as little harm as possible to other conscient beings. Another great teacher of this philosophy is Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen Buddhist monk.
Yes. Well, can you tell us how you incorporate your spirituality in your day-to-day work and your activities?
Well, let's see. I try my best to practice my vegan way. I go to Unity Church these days. I joined this past year to have a community of spiritual brothers and sisters. Seeing a few friends. I don't have many friends. If my goal is maybe to have three or four wonderful friends.
Mm.
And I'm very, you know, but one of my friends, Ron Van Oostrin, leads drumming circles, and quite often I go to drumming circles. In fact, I do have a poem about the last drumming circle I went to.
I'd love to hear that. Yes, why don't you share that with us now?
Okay. This is called Drumming Circle at Sunset, June 22nd, 2013. Through the parting trees, she slowly enters. She waited for strong sun to go home. Round, profound, perigee moon glows silently in her pale peach evening dress. Trying not to disrupt the drummers in the circle, she does not succeed. As we each behold her, we are struck with awe by her beauty. The drumming gets quiet. In the center of the circle, a blazing fire, fueled by frankincense and myrrh, snaps and coughs out smoke, choking on the released pain and failings the drummers fed it. A flute soothes, its tender song floats upon the wind, and the drumming gets quiet. Beneath swirling, moonlit clouds, more friends arrive in the course of the night. They are shadows until we recognize them by the sounds of their voices. They bring their dogs. Before beating their drums, they speak softly of matters they care about. As the drumming goes on, louder and louder from surrounding trees and fields, frogs, birds, insects, and unknown creatures join in, singing, chirping, and buzzing in harmonic rhythm. Fireflies, shy at first, twinkle in growing numbers, and the drumming gets quiet. Intermittently throughout the night, we think about why we are here. For relief from the heaviness of the day. To forgive ourselves for yielding to temptations. To offer unconditional acceptance. To free ourselves from obstacles keeping us from helping the world. We seek peace. We want to love better. We want to say thank you. Nothing else is important. These thoughts eventually melt into dreams, and the drumming gets quiet. We set down our drums and embrace in a circle, sharing blessings, singing ohms and more ohms. As we part, we notice a table is set with nourishing food, carrots, hummus, so delicious, and how especially sweet, eating juicy strawberries in the moonlight with friends.
Oh, that's beautiful, Beth. Thank you so much. You know, the hour has gone so quickly, and I've only covered some of the ground that I'd hoped to cover with you. I was going to ask you what your vision for yourself and for the world is, and perhaps some of that was captured in that poem that you just read.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, that the vision for myself, it's a very hard question. I, of course, would like to see myself as a compassionate force in the world. I'd like to see myself as one who takes affirming actions towards people who are suffering to help them relieve their suffering. I would like to deepen my empathy towards others and, of course, continue my work on trying to embrace my shadow and stand in my own authentic true self. I guess that's about it.
That sounds wonderful. It really does. Do you have a vision for the world?
Well, it probably isn't comprehensive, but I would definitely like to see the many, many people all around the world unite with honoring the environment, working towards respecting the earth, stopping like the hydrofracking and fossil fuel dependency, and all pitch in and put our minds to getting off of the dependency on fossil fuels. I'd like to see no more factory farms, no more circuses, no more zoos, other things that would otherwise show disrespect to the majesty of the other living beings. I'd like to see all of the children of the world be able to be fed. Now, that is one other reason to go vegan, is that it allows more land to be used not for the grazing of cattle, but to be used for the production of food so that all of the people could eat more easily. So those are some ideas.
Thank you very much, Beth. I hope that you'll come back and join us again and share some more of your poetry. It's going to be time for us to close now. And so once again, we do come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we're all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.